Thank you very much for this invitation. I'm very happy to be here and to meet all of you. Like I just said, I'm working at the Institute for History now at Leiden University. And my current project is much more historical than the work I'm going to present now. What I'm working on now, on at the moment, is also a comparison between Germany and France and the Netherlands, and also about family migration policy making. But then from the 50s until the 80s, perhaps the 1990s, if the archive material allows me to extend the research period into the 1990s. But before I started this research project, I worked for a couple of years on much more contemporary policy and political dynamics. And one of the major things that I looked at was the impact of the EU on national policy making and political debates. As you may know, the EU has been developing asylum and migration policy since the 1990s, mainly since the early 2000s after the Treaty of Amsterdam. And this has really changed the nature of the game of making migration policies within the European Union completely. And I'm fascinated by this ongoing process of policymakers starting to realize that their job is actually completely different now from what it was 10 years ago, and from people around this policymaking circles starting to get to grips with what's happening and how these new actors are shaping the migration policies in Europe. What I'm going to present today is an article I wrote together with Laura Bloch, who, if you don't know her, is a German scholar. She graduated, she did her PhD at the European University Institute, defended in 2012 about German family migration policies. The article is actually already published. I hope you don't mind my presenting something that is already published. So if you want to read it, I can send you a copy with great pleasure. Just send me an email. I will also draw a little bit on other articles I published on a similar subject. One which I wrote with Maarten Vink, which really focuses on the impact of the EU on the Dutch case and tries to speak to Europeanization theories that are used within the literature to explain migration policy making. And also a little bit on some work I did on the pre-departure integration requirement in six European countries and how there's been policy transfer among them that I've been trying to get published in the comparative migration studies, hoping it will come through. I can also send you the version I submitted if you're interested in that. So for today, what our research started from was the observation that two things happened over the last 10 years about at the same time. First, we saw a restrictive turn in family migration policies, so a series of restrictive reforms in different member states of the European Union, including, our three countries, France, Germany, and the Netherlands, but also Belgium, the UK, certainly, Denmark, of course, Austria, Sweden, Finland. And next to that, or in parallel to that, we saw the introduction of EU law on family migration. So in 2003, for the first time, there was a directive on family reunification, which is binding on member states, which means that whenever national laws and this new EU law might clash with the EU law that comes first. And that's the first time that there's ever been EU law on family migration. So there's this major step in the Europeanization of family migration law, and at the same time, there's, in many member states of the EU, there's a restrictive policy turn. And we wanted to know whether these two developments were connected, whether they were causally connected in the sense that this Europeanization was producing or had enabled, somehow contributed to, the restrictive turn in policies. Which brought us to this research question: to which extent is the restrictive turn in family migration policies the result of Europeanization? We focus empirically on Germany, the Netherlands and France, which are the countries we know best, and also certainly the forerunners of, among the forerunners, I should say, of this restrictive term. We looked at parliamentary documents, so no archive material for such recent periods, unfortunately, but parliamentary material to reconstruct the parliamentary debates, but also the government proposals and the political debates. I'm going to start with giving you an overview of the most important policy developments in these three countries over the last 10 years. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about our analytical framework, so about how to think about the Europeanization of migration policies. And I'm going to end, and that will be the major part of the presentation, with the empirical analysis. This is very small, right? Can you, in the back, can you see anything? Or should I talk you to it completely? Very little, okay. This is an overview of the most important policy reforms in family migration policies in these three countries since the introduction of the Family Reunification Directive, so since 2003. The Family Reunification Directive only applies to third country nationals living in member states who want to bring in foreign family members. It doesn't apply to citizens of the member states who want to bring in foreign family members, but many, even most, of these reforms actually apply to citizens as well as to third country nationals. EU nationals living in other countries fall under a completely different regime, under the free movement regime, which this article is not about, and I'm not going to talk about in this presentation. The first one we noticed was the minimum age. The Family Reunification Directive allows countries to set a minimum age of no more than 21 years. And all our three countries have introduced or raised an age requirement in these in the last 10 years. So in the Netherlands, it was raised from 18 to 21 in 2004. And in Germany and in France, a minimum age of 18 was introduced. There is a clause about income requirement also in the directive. So the directive allows member states to require that the applicant has a sustainable income sufficient to for a family. It was raised in all three countries, but in France it was raised in this kind of tweaky way where before there was an individual assessment and now there isn't anymore, or at least that's how I interpret the wording of the regulation, which is quite fuzzy. And what I do get is that it can be extended up to 120% of the minimum wage depending on the number of children. So the income requirement has been made variable depending on the size of the family. In the Netherlands, it was raised to 120% for all families, but then they had to bring it down again, and we'll come back to that after a ruling of the EU court in 2010. And in Germany, it was raised for particular categories of citizens. There didn't used to be an income requirement for citizens who wanted to bring in foreign family members, and it was introduced for those citizens who, I can't remember the exact wording, and the exact wording is actually relevant here, but for those citizens who also had connections to the country of their partner. So what it was meant to do was to apply to those people of migrant origin who would marry someone of the same country of origin. And this doesn't have anything to do with the EU court, but the Federal Administrative Court condemned that raise too, because it was making illicit distinctions among citizens. So the Dutch and the German attempt at raising the income requirement have been annulled. There was a residence requirement of 12 months in France, so you had to live at least 12 months in France before you could bring in your family. That was raised to 18. In the Netherlands, there was no residence requirement, and it was introduced. And then there's the pre-departure integration requirements. So that's language requirements, and in France and in the Netherlands also a requirement to know something about the country, that you have to, in Germany and the Netherlands, you have to prove a basic level of knowledge before you can actually get a visa and enter the country. In France, you have to participate in a test, and if it's not sufficient, then you have to participate in a course. But even if you fail the course, you can still go to France. So in France, there's only an obligation to participate. In Germany and the Netherlands, there's an obligation to actually pass the test, so to reach minimum level. The point of this paper that we want to make, of the table that we want to make, is clearly there is a restrictive time. There have been a substantial number of reforms, and all of them have gone in a restrictive direction. Now the analytical framework. I don't know how familiar you are with this literature, but there's a lot of literature about the EU and what it's been doing in the field of migration policy since the 1990s. And certainly in the 1990s, but still today, the dominant theoretical framework is an intergovernmentalist one. So a framework that assumes that member states are in control of the European integration process and its consequences also. And the main idea was actually launched by Virginie Giraudon, and it was that member states shift to the EU level, so they move the policy-making process to Brussels, because that allows them to escape constraints that weigh upon them in the national arena. So political constraints in terms of parliamentary opposition to their restrictive reform plans, or of course opposition from national courts. So the idea was, if we move to Brussels, then we don't have to deal with either those parliaments or those courts, and we can build Fortress Europe the way we want it. I do think that this perspective captured really important policy dynamics in the 1990s. But Amsterdam has changed this completely. I'm getting out of breath. I think I have to accommodate my changing physics. Yeah, this is better. Can you still hear me? Yes, yeah. Shout if you can't. What Amsterdam did was communitarize migration policies. So it shifted from the third to the first pillar, if that means anything to you. The Commission got a right of initiative. The Parliament, slowly, gradually, but still we're getting there, got to be an equal player with the Council in making law. And perhaps most importantly, the court got a say in migration policy matters. And anything that came out of the EU from that moment on was EU law. So binding EU law. In other words, Amsterdam has produced a major shift in power from the member states to the supranational institutions in this whole business of making migration policies.
When was the Amsterdam Treaty?
In 1999. Adopted in 1997 and then entered into force. Or 1997? 1997, right?
Yeah,
and then entered into force?
I'm not sure.
Maybe. What also our criticism on this intergovernmentalist perspective, the second point of criticism, less important than the first one but still, is that it neglects what happens between member states. It's focused very much on the dynamics between the EU level institutions, parliament, courts, and member states, and it doesn't look very much at process of transfer and changing of ideas among member states, which we think are very important. So we propose this analytical framework. And to tell you the truth, this is the part of the article that, to say I'm dissatisfied with it would be too strong, but I think that this is the part where I would hope that we can push it further in the future. It has really helped us to write this particular article and to make this analysis, But I'm not sure how generalizable it is. So if you have any comments on that afterwards, I would actually be very grateful. The first thing that we did was, in the EU literature on Europeanization more broadly, there is a distinction between different dynamics of Europeanization, what is usually called vertical and horizontal Europeanization, where vertical is assumed to be binding, so there is a law and then the member states have to do it, and horizontal is more soft law, open method of coordination, where there is a stimulation for member states to learn from each other's best practices. And the assumption is that vertical Europeanization happens in certain policy fields where there is binding law, and horizontal Europeanization happens in other policy fields where there is no binding law, so in education and in social policies. And what we actually observed, we thought that this whole horizontal-vertical metaphor, it got us confused at some point, because member states actually, they go to Brussels and they negotiate there about binding law, but in the course of these negotiating processes, they also learn from each other, and what if the exchange between member states happens in Brussels, and is it vertical or horizontal? How does it, the whole metaphor didn't seem to work. And most importantly, what we noticed was just focusing on this one particular binding instrument of EU law, the Family Reunification Directive, we noticed that it triggered different types of Europeanization at the same time. So we thought we're going to let go of this horizontal-vertical metaphor and try something else. We're going to try something more actor-centered. We're going to look at Europeanization that is driven by the member states, and Europeanization that is driven by supranational institutions. And that worked super well in our particular case because the supranational institutions and the member states have divergent preferences, divergent interests. Now, I think that's a constellation that actually happens quite often, but in this particular constellation, Europeanization is enabling for member states when it is member state driven. So it helps member states to accomplish whatever they want to accomplish. If it's the type of dynamics that is pushed by member states themselves. But there are also mechanisms, processes of Europeanization that are driven more by supranational institutions. And these processes we find are more constraining. So to bring this back also in, or to relate this to the intergovernmentalist perspective that I just mentioned, the intergovernmentalist perspective assumes that Europeanization is only enabling for member states. That member states makes this choice of making EU policies because it helps them to achieve their restrictive policy goals. And we say, well, there's different types of Europeanization in play that may have enabling and constraining effects. I'm entering the empirical part of my analysis. The very first part, where member states were negotiating the directive, we found was neither enabling nor constraining, so not the most interesting empirical part to analyze. All three countries had the goal to ensure that the directive would require as little change to national policies as possible. So they tried to make sure that their existing national policies could remain exactly the same as they were once the directive was adopted, and that any plans that they had that were already in play, let's say, that they would be able to execute those. We found no evidence at all that there were plans that they couldn't get through on the national level that they would put forward on the EU level. So there was support, political support, very broadly for whatever they were proposing in the EU level. So we didn't find any evidence here of venue shopping, as Virginie Giraudon would propose it. And although Germany and the Netherlands were certainly more influential than France in this whole negotiating process, all three countries were very content with the results. So they all thought they had managed to achieve this first and major goal to ensure that the directive would require as little change as possible. And actually, when they did this first formal step of of implementing the directive. The changes made were minimal. I can't even remember them, but they were about, in the Netherlands, they were about enabling the parents of minor refugees to come in certain very specific circumstances. There were these really, really very minor tweaks of national policies that had to be done, but otherwise all the major framework of the policies remained unchanged when these three countries implemented the directive. But they made a whole series of further reforms with reference to the directive, even if these reforms were not compulsory under the directive. So there's a the directive sets minimum norms. It says member states are allowed to have an age requirement, for instance, but it cannot be more than 21. They are allowed to have an income requirement, which cannot be higher than this. So it sets a ceiling to restriction, but then they can be as liberal as they want. It has a lot of optional clauses, like they can introduce integration requirements if they want, but they don't have to. What member states did was, what governments did, was refer to the directive to justify their reforms in a way hinting at that the directive, even if it wasn't obligatory on the directive, it was good because it was in the directive to have certain types of reforms. I hope I can explain to you what I mean. This is the Dutch Minister of Immigration, who in 2004 argued that the new integration requirements, so that was the whole, you know, integration abroad thing, fits with recent developments in European migration law. What she's trying to do is to make it sound like it's in line with the spirit of the directive or something like that, right? She wouldn't say that she has to do it, that the directive made her do it. That would be an outright lie. She didn't say that, but she said something like, it's a good idea because it's there. What the Germans did, here's Mr. Schäuble, he called the immigration law of 2007, which had these language requirements for spouses and a new income requirement and a new age requirement, he called it the Richtlinienumsetzungsgesetz. So the Directive Implementation Act, yes, Germans can make very long words. And only when the opposition criticized that and said they called it hypocritical exploitation of the directive to pretend that it was part of the implementation of the directive to introduce a language requirement, for instance, then he said, well, no, we don't have to do it. It's not just the directive, it's also these ideas that we have that we just think are good ideas. But there is this trying to create the impression that it's all part of the European integration process to introduce these reforms. And the French were the strongest at doing that. They, when they talked about the income requirement and how they were raising it, they said it was inspired by the directive. And when they talked about the age requirement, they called it adapting French policies to the directive. And with regard to the integration requirement, which was very controversial in France, here's Minister Hortefeux, who said, we cannot ceaselessly claim harmonization of European politics and then stick to words. Action is needed. If we really want European integration, progress will be needed on this subject. This makes very little sense. There were, in the sense that there were three or four countries at that point who were having these pre-departure integration requirements, and it was an option in the Family Reunification Directive. It wasn't obligatory at all. But he presents the introduction of these integration requirements as part of a harmonization in Europe that is desirable in itself. What Laura and I kind of saw was that there are these norms that were laid down in the EU directive and that were meant to be a minimum level of protection of the right to family migration. So they were meant as a, what do you call it? Minimum level is the best word I can find now. What France and Germany and the Netherlands did was to reverse this goal by turning these minimum norms into a desirable form of harmonization. So moving towards minimum norms was presented as we're all converging, harmonizing in Europe, and that's a good thing. So they created a race to the bottom in this way. Could you follow this argument? and built legitimacy for a restrictive term in their family migration policies by referring to the EU law. So that's the first way we saw that the Europeanization helped or contributed to the legitimizing a restrictive reform in member states. We saw a different way too, which was more related to what people would used to call horizontal Europeanization, so transfer among member states. The creation of this EU law has also created a great deal of networks and venues for policymakers, from the highest level of ministers to the lowest level of civil servants, meeting, knowing each other, exchanging ideas. And you really have to think of it as that in The Hague, the policy officer who's responsible for family migration now has the telephone number of his Portuguese colleague. He didn't used to have that. And they can call each other and exchange. So from these kind of informal connections, but also there is the European Migration Network, which is explicitly aimed at exchanging information about policy practices in different countries and at countries learning from each other. And we saw very clearly that in France and Germany and the Netherlands, this policy transfer has contributed to restrictive reform. What countries do, and I can't make it more sound better than this, is they say other people are doing it too, so it's a good idea. They don't actually come up with proof that it's working in other countries or something like that. So it's not about proving efficiency by showing that other countries have experienced it with it. It's really just the argument other countries are doing it too, so it's a good idea. It's very playground-like. The other kids are doing it too, so it can't be that bad. French, again, were very strong in this one. Sarkozy, when he first launched the idea of these pre-departure integration requirements, he did it when he was Minister of Immigration, but also when he was a candidate for the presidential election. So this was a speech he gave. I hesitated to call it an election speech. Officially, it wasn't. Officially, he was speaking as the Minister of Immigration, but certainly everybody was listening to him as the presidential candidate. I want us to follow the example of the Netherlands, which has put in place integration tests for family migrants to take in their country of origin. Germany and Denmark plan to adopt a similar test, which marks a real European convergence. This is three countries out of 27. It's a real European convergence. Of course, the rhetorics are interesting, but it's also I find it interesting to see that apparently common practice in Europe has a certain legitimacy. The fact that other people are doing it too has a moral value. There is a legitimacy in common, a norm that arises from common practice, apparently. Auch der Föhr did something very different when he defended the income requirements. Many European countries take the size of the family into account, so to calculate the amount of income requirements, such as Germany, Spain, or Italy. In the Germany and the Netherlands, there were similar references to other countries when they were presenting their restrictive reforms. Many, many references to Denmark, especially, so to the 24-year-old minimum age requirement, to the attachment test. If you don't know what it is, I can explain it to you. To the idea that you can only access social benefits after a certain residence if you're a family migrant. And what Germany and Netherlands also did with us, which I thought was interesting, to present themselves as models. So it's not only about copying other people, it's also about being copied. Rita Verdonk again said, the Netherlands is taking the lead in Europe when it comes to civic integration abroad. Many member states are following these developments with great interest, and I expect that other member states will follow our example. So this is the same argument, but the other way around. If people are doing the same thing, then it can't be a bad idea if other people are copying us. And Germany also wanted the trendsetter role. Schäuble argued, we are setting an example for many countries in Europe. The provision to require language skills prior to family reunification is part of the asylum and migration package that has been presented by the French presidency. We are absolutely setting an example here.
So when they are implementing optional clauses of the directive, member states look at each other's policy practices and learn from each other. And they build legitimacy for their restrictive reforms by making this argument, by showing other people, other countries are doing it too. This transfer, I think, is an important part of the Europeanization dynamics created by the introduction of the EU directive. And this is relevant with regard also to the literature, because these are processes of transfer that are triggered by a binding EU law instrument, so not by OMC like, you know, open method of coordination like instruments, but really by hard EU law. Now, there are also constraining dynamics. And the most important actor in constraining member states in their restrictive term is the court. As I said, the court has been made competent in EU migration and asylum law matters by the Treaty of Amsterdam. Its competence was limited at first. It has full competence by now. But even when it was still limited, so both the two first cases was still when its competence was limited, and already it was very influential. The first case was brought in 2006. It was an action for annulment which was brought to court by the parliament. So the parliament thought that certain elements of the Family Reunification Directive were contrary to the European Convention on Human Rights. The court dismissed the action for annulment, but it clarified, kind of, it made a number of very important statements about what the directive was about and what it meant. First, it said that the Family Reunification Directive sets a subjective right to family reunification. What that means is that if an applicant fulfills the conditions set in the directive, member states have to grant them the right to family reunification. So member states don't have a choice anymore. It's not a discretionary decision anymore to let family migrants in or not. If anyone who fulfills the conditions has to be let in. In the Netherlands, for instance, that didn't exist. So that's a really new. It's the Constitutional Court in Germany had a similar approach already, but in many EU countries this is new. Also, and I find this. Somehow I find it funny. There are preambles to the directive, and one of the preambles said, you know what, when you read a piece of law and it starts with whereas this and whereas that and whereas, three pages, and then it starts with the actual legal text. One of the whereases is that the directive aims at facilitating the integration of migrants by making family life possible through reunification. Now, I'm pretty sure, I would like to ask the Dutch negotiators and the German negotiators, but I'm pretty sure they thought, well, whatever we put there, it's just some nice words. You know, it's just the introduction, and then we say something nice, and then we get to the part which really matters. But the court took this part and took it to be the spirit of the law, which determines the entire interpretation of the text that follows. And it says, what it says is that the Family Reunification Directive is meant to facilitate family migration. So member states have to make family migration possible. That's the aim. And it also says that family migration is good for migrants' integration, which is the exact opposite causal relation that is assumed in many member states at the moment, certainly in the Netherlands and Germany and France. The assumption is that family integration is bad for integration because it's the wrong people who are coming in for the wrong reasons. And what the court also said is that the general principles of EU legal order apply, which means that pretty vague clauses such as public order or minimum income, that member states thought left them enough room to do what they thought was the best policy. The court is going to interpret them according to its existing jurisprudence in other fields of law. So there is a pretty specific meaning of public order, not using social assistance, so minimum income, and several other terms used in the Family Reunification Directive, and that is what the court is going to apply. And then came the first actual ruling, and the Netherlands was the first country to be condemned by the court in the Schakroen ruling of 2010. where the court argued that 120% of the minimum wage was too high and the Netherlands had to bring it back to 100%. And that was a very clear case of a clause about income requirement that was the result of 5 years of, I don't know how many, dozens and dozens of text proposals from all these different member states, where at the end there was a clause that was so vague that everybody thought, well, with this we'll be fine. And then the court came and gave it a very specific meaning. So the text says something like stable and regular resources which are sufficient to maintain himself and the member of his or her family without recourse to the social assistance system of the member state concerned. And the Netherlands thought that they could put it at 120% of the minimum wage because below that you can still have recourse to specific forms of help in if your washing machine breaks down, so for particular emergencies, or you can have access to local subsidies or to housing, social housing. But the court said no, 100% of the minimum wage is the maximum that you can require within this particular clause. So the Dutch government complied and lowered its income requirement. And then there was a case in 2011 that is a bit particular, but because there was no ruling, but it was a case about the pre-departure integration requirement. There was an Afghan woman and her 8 children and her husband were already living in the Netherlands, and she just never managed to pass the test. And then it was brought before the EU court whether this was compatible with the directive. In the Netherlands, coincidence or not, I certainly don't think it was a coincidence, gave the lady a permit, thank you, before the court could rule. So the court never ruled. But the commission did present its opinion to the court before the case was actually withdrawn. And the commission said very clearly, we think that pre-departure integration requirements are contrary to the directive. Since then, member states have really tried to avoid any case coming before the court. So selectively granting permits wherever anyone was likely to present a case to court. But there is now an ongoing court case by a German court, put forward by a German court, and it hasn't, so far the German government hasn't withdrawn it yet. So it might actually come to a ruling and then we'll know. In general, the commission has really been on the court's side on this one. So very much pushing this, that the directive is meant to facilitate family migration, which has led to interesting discussions between member states. And here you see the Dutch Minister of Immigration and Commissioner Malmström clearly disagreeing on something. actually, the commission has launched an infringement procedure in May of last year against Germany, so a procedure for breaching EU law because of the pre-departure integration requirement. So if Germany sticks to its position, then the commission might ask the court to pronounce itself on this issue. What you can also read, and I have to be super fast, you can also really see that how constraining the directive is in that member states are not implementing the policy plans of their own preference. So it's not just existing policies that are condemned, it's also policy proposals that are blocked. The last, and I'm going to focus just on the Dutch case that I know best, the last 3 governments have had shorter or longer wish lists of measures that they would like to implement but that they can't because the directive prohibits it. And they've been trying to get the EU level to change, but it's not so easy to change an EU directive once it's adopted. You have to restart the whole negotiation process. And the Commission has to agree to start it. So the Balkan undergovernment, which was a center-left government, wanted to introduce education and integration requirements for the sponsor, which are not mentioned in the directive, so you can't do it, because the directive, you can't introduce anything that's not in the directive, that the directive doesn't allow. This is the one that was supported by the Freedom Party. And here you see Gertlier, so the Minister of Immigration, stuck between Europe and the Freedom Party, which I think is a telling image. They had a list of 7 measures that they wanted to introduce, but that they couldn't. only in the field of family migration because of the Family Reunification Directive, including higher income, higher age, and education requirements. And also, the current government wants to tighten the income requirement and raise the age requirement, and is still trying to lobby at the EU level to get the Commission, and the Commission even to launch a renegotiation of the directive, which is not going to happen, but they're now, I think, trying to do something with the implementation of, you know, the interpretation or implementation guidelines that the Commission has to write in to try to push these in their own direction. Which brings me to my conclusion. Europeanization is our major point, has enabled and constrained the restrictive reform of family migration policies. It has enabled it by helping member states, governments to legitimize restrictive reform. First by referring to the directive, and secondly by referring to other member states' practices. It has also empowered supranational institutions like the Commission and certainly the Court to maintain a minimum level of rights protection and thus to limit restrictive reform. So there is this, people who argue that there is this fortress Europe are overly pessimistic in our view, and people who argue that there is a Europe of rights and that if we just put Europe on everything and then everything will be okay for migrants are overly optimistic. There is a much more complex and multiple dynamics going on at the EU level that both enable and constrain member states. Thank you.